I'm kind of trying not to set a double standard between here and Bloomington. They are not permitted to have coffee and goodies during their Bible study over there in their hall, so I am not permitted either to have them here. So I'm trying not to set a double standard for them and enjoy anything while they're not able to enjoy it in their hall. The first Bible study is a short one. We're going to try to do cover a question that came in. Our question was asked recently here. It says, was there a third altar outside of the camp to sacrifice the red heifer and the ashes used for purification? I just heard bits and pieces, so I'm confused. A good question that came in. Every once in a while, people will ask about this, and every once in a while, there'll be an article somewhere in a magazine or a newspaper or something about it, or something that some event has happened in conjunction with this. Numbers 19 is probably the place that has the most information about the red heifer and also the altar that was used to deal with the red heifer. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, this is the ordinance of the law, which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, that they bring you a red heifer, without spot, wherein is no blemish, and upon which never came milk. So this is a young female, and you shall give her unto Eleazar the priest, that he may bring her forth without the camp, and one shall slay her before his face. So another Levitical priest was to slay the heifer before Aaron's face. In other words, he was to be present and watching as this was done, so that everything went according to the way it should. And Eleazar the priest shall take of her blood with his finger, and sprinkle of her blood directly before the tabernacle of the congregation seven times. And one shall bring the heifer in his sight, her skin, her flesh, her blood, with her dung shall he burn. And the priest shall take the cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet, and cast it into the midst of the burning of the heifer. Certain things were to be added to what was being burned. And then the priest shall wash his clothes, and he shall bathe his flesh in water, and afterward he shall come into the camp, and the priest shall be unclean until the even. Now this is the priest who has actually done the sacrificing here. And he that burns her shall wash his clothes in water, and bathe his flesh in water, and shall be unclean until the even. And a man that is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer, and shall lay them up without the camp in a clean place, and it shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel. For a water of separation, it is a purification for sin. And he that gathereth the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the even. And it shall be unto the children of Israel and unto the stranger that sojourns among them for a statute forever. Now why did they do this? There's probably a little bit more on it throughout the chapter here, but you get the general idea, and chapter 19 pretty much covers that subject in its entirety. The Bible doesn't tell us a great deal about the red heifer, but it does give us this chapter and the associated information in the chapter here about the altar upon which the red heifer was sacrificed. The altar upon which the heifer was sacrificed is sometimes called the third altar. I don't think that's necessarily because the Bible names it as a third altar. It doesn't. It's just simply that it talks about the altars, and it names the first two, but then doesn't say anything about a third. So I think people have basically said, well, this must be the third altar that's being talked about. God's instructions were that the high priest went outside of the camp of Israel and watched while another priest killed the red heifer before him and then placed it on something to be burned whole. Now, whatever that something was that it had to be placed on to be burned whole in order to capture the ashes and other things that were mixed in here with the burning, had to be some kind of an altar. There had to be some kind of a trap or something in which to capture the ashes underneath, and whoever separated the ashes and put them into a container or whatever, and did the cleaning up, or whatever was unclean, for some period of time, because he was going to be touching carbonized portions of body and whatever else, so it was just simply a it was an unclean job, so he had to remain unclean, I think, for 7 days afterwards. But then individuals who were who found themselves unclean and needed to become clean would then have to ask for a priest for the water of separation in order to be cleansed. So the process of providing that water or that purification water was a process of killing the animal. But in killing the animal, then whoever did do that had to, became unclean too. So, you know, I suspect the Jews have something in their midrash or in their Talmud that probably gives a great deal more detail about the red heifer and the altar and the sacrifice and all of that, but I don't think that's specifically important. What is important about the red heifer comes in terms of today and in terms of prophecy and in terms of what the Jews did with the ashes of the red heifer, and they were mixed into a water, a pure spring water or whatever that they would obtain, and then they would mix the ashes into the water in some small amount. I don't know exactly what the proportions are. The Jews probably have some record of how it was done. We don't know specifically what it was today. The red heifer had to be used to clean or cleanse things. It could be used to cleanse the tabernacle. It could be used to cleanse the temple. It could be used to cleanse the priests or the instruments of service that took place in the tabernacle. And it will also have to be used in order to cleanse the future temple. It is essential that a red heifer be obtained that was used for the cleansing ceremony. The Jewish Mishnah and the Talmud may go into more detail about that, but I don't know a great deal more about it than that. What's important is kind of future, how we look at the red heifer today, what does it mean today? And I believe the thinking about the importance of the red heifer in the minds of many who are concerned about the development of end time events is probably pretty much as follows, and I'll try to give you a scenario of it. In order for the biblical prophecies to take place, as far as the future is concerned, and the reconstructed temple, or at the very least an altar, according to Revelation 11, for instance, there it clearly mentions a temple and an altar in the tribulation, and the beast sets up his statue inside of the temple or inside of the holy place, representing himself as God. I think it says that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4 as well. It talks about the beast setting himself up, or the false prophet setting himself up in the temple. In order for there to be a new temple, so the argument goes, the entire site would first have to be purified. Well, how do you purify the site? Well, again, we're back to the red heifer. You have to have a red heifer in order to make the water of purification in order to cleanse the site for the altar or for the temple. And the entire site would have to be purified. If you go back and look at how Solomon did it before Solomon's temple, or you go back to Hezekiah and his temple, 2 Chronicles 2:4 or 2 Chronicles 29:18, they both give you kind of a contrast of this purification ceremony in terms of the dedication of the temple and the dedication of the second temple in 2 Chronicles 29:18. With specific mention of purification, talks about it. Ezra also talks about it in Ezra chapter 6, verses 14 through 16. And this means, basically what it means is that the rabbins who would have to have the appropriate water of purification, so the line goes, that they would be able to have, would be able to purify the temples and the instruments in the temple. And, of course, you have to have a red heifer to make the ashes that go in the water of purification. So it's kind of a catch-22. If you don't have a red heifer, you can't purify. And if you can't purify, then you can't have a temple. And if you can't have a temple, then you can't have a place to burn the red heifer, and you know, or you can't have an altar, and so it kind of goes around in a circle until you get the red heifer, is basically what happens. That's why it becomes so important in the news occasionally. You'll hear an article that they've discovered a new red heifer in Israel, and it'll be all over Rosh Hashanah and a number of the other newspapers and things in you know, the Jerusalem Post or whatever. You'll have articles all over the place about it, like they did 6 or 7 years ago when they had their first red heifer in many, many years, and they thought it was going to be pure and it was going to be correct. Unfortunately, it wasn't. When it came to full age, the ravens watch the red heifer until it comes to full age, and they are checking it constantly to see that every hair on it is red and not some other color. And unfortunately, this particular red heifer, two hairs were not red on this one. So all of the hullabaloo had to be cast aside because that one wasn't the red heifer they were expecting. Now, they are rare and they are difficult to find. If you follow the religious section over there in some of their magazines and newspapers, you'll hear articles about these kinds of things happening. To give you an idea of how rare and how many there have been, how many red heifers are born, on which every hair on them is red, so to speak, the Mishnah records that through the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem in 70 A.D., from the time of Moses to the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., there have only been 9 red heifers. 9. All through that entire time. They are obviously waiting for the 10th red heifer at this point in Israel. And their only option is a very slim chance, of course. But the only other option, I guess, is a very slim chance that somehow they would discover the ashes of the 9th red heifer underneath the temple somewhere today, which is probably a very unlikely chance that they would be able to find the water of separation or, you know, some of the ashes of the red heifer or whatever underneath the temple. The Jews may have preserved it as they approached 70 A.D. There are legends of them hiding all kinds of things underneath the temple. And then, of course, cementing it all in and closing it all off so nobody could get in there. That's a possibility. But it's a pretty slim possibility, I think, in terms of actually finding something under there. There's a real good article written about the temple itself. It's written by the Temple Institute. It was published in 2009, in September of 2009. By Borek Fishman. It was entitled Jews in Israel Build the Altar for the Third Temple. The Third Temple is very significant. The Third Altar, I'm trying to remember, there is a Third Altar. I'm trying to remember what the names of the first two altars were. I thought I wrote them in here. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I skipped over them. But I thought I did. Looks like I've skipped over it, and I don't see it. Okay. The first altar, of course, being the brazen altar, where the sacrifices were made, which usually sits right outside of the tabernacle. That's considered to be the first altar, and it's the main altar. And then inside of the tabernacle itself, there is an incense altar, and that's considered to be the second altar. And it is where they burn the incense within the tabernacle, the tent itself. So therefore, any other altar outside of those two would probably be classified as a third altar, even though the Bible doesn't mention a third altar specifically. But if we had to name them and we were talking about different altars, I suppose the one on which the red heifer would have been offered, and there's a reason for it. You know, why wasn't it offered on the brazen altar? Anybody think of a reason? This red heifer had to be used for purification. Therefore, the purest place to find to handle this red heifer would be outside of the camp. Right? Where is the sin? The sin is in the camp, right? So if you want something to purify for sin, you'd want them to be sacrificed outside of a camp. That's part of why there's a little bit of controversy or legend about, you know, why Christ was sacrificed outside of Jerusalem or, you know, taken out to Golgotha to be sacrificed. He was kind of outside of a camp, if you want to put it that way, when he was sacrificed. There are many traditions about that kind of thing. But let me read the article from the Temple Institute. More than 1930 years ago, the Romans invaded the land of Israel and destroyed the Jewish temple, which had stood on the Temple Mount for over 400 years. Since then, the sacred precincts have passed into the hands of a series of owners. First, the property was under Rome, then pagans, then Byzantium, then Islam, then Egypt, then the Crusaders, then Islam again, then Turkey, then England, just to name a few of the major powers that have controlled the area. In 1967, the State of Israel conquered the Temple Mount, and the property once again fell into the hands of the Jews. Many soldiers who helped conquer the Temple Mount in the 1967 war were disheartened when General Moshe Dayan, head of military operations, ceded day-to-day religious control of the property to the Muslim religious authorities. One soldier, Israel Ariel, later became Rabbi Ariel, founded an organization, the Temple Institute, and dedicated his life to rebuilding the temple. The Temple Institute is a thriving educational center and museum immersed in building garments, vessels, implements fit to be used in future temple worship. Recently, the Institute undertook another ambitious project, the construction of an altar, which can be used for ritual sacrifice in the future temple. Construction of the altar began on July 29th of 2009, the anniversary of the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. The Temple Institute chose to build the new altar 3 meters by 3 meters by 2 meters tall. This is the minimum size needed for temple use, and it will enable the organization to transport the altar to the Temple Mount at such time that political authorities grant permission for the building of the third temple. The altar, in keeping with Jewish law, has been made of stones that were never used for building and have not been touched by implements of iron. The stones chosen for the project are being held together by a special mixture of pitch, which experts say is especially resistant to heat. For now, it will stand outside of the Temple Mount. End of the article. But that kind of gives you a little bit of what's going on, or a little bit that has been going on in the last year. In summary, we know certain prophecies involve the sacrifices and involve, of course, the cessation of sacrifices. In Daniel 8, we find this little horn that is symbolic of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, a second century ruler, who was the forerunner and the type of the coming beast of Revelation. He causes the sacrifices in the temple to cease. Again, in type, the sacrifices will be stopped by the future beast invading Jerusalem, just as the 3.5 years of Great Tribulation get underway. Now, here's the significance, of course, of the red heifer. In order to have the sacrifices cease, they must have started, right? You have to start them in order to cease them. And in order to start them, you have to build an altar, at least, perhaps parts of the temple too, we don't know. And in order to build the altar in the temple, they have to be purified before they can be used to sacrifice on. And in order to be purified, they have to be sprinkled with the water of separation. And in order to sprinkle with the water of separation, you have to have ashes from the red heifer in order to do that. So that's how it all ties together in terms of the red heifer and what all is going on with it. I think that kind of covers the picture in general. I don't have an awful lot of details as far as what the Jews, you know, all the parts of the ceremony and the things that they did, and how they did it and how they mixed the water of separation and all those things. I don't know exactly how that was done. The Jews apparently have a record of how they did that. If there's any questions about that before we quit on that subject. I think I've kind of beat a red heifer to death here, but no, I'm just kidding. Any questions on it, as far as the red heifer goes? Every once in a while, if you watch the news, you'll see something come through about a red heifer. They'll say something, what's the big deal about a red heifer? Well, now you know the background behind the red heifer, and you can kind of figure out why they're so excited about it if they have one. And as rare as they are, you can understand the excitement, and you know there probably will be a tenth red heifer, you know, in order for a lot of the prophecies to be fulfilled in the New Testament. Something's got to happen as far as a red heifer is concerned. It's got to be coming. Okay, any other questions on that? I've got another subject. I hate to start it with only 5 minutes left, but I will turn over to another topic. I don't have any other questions at the moment, so you're certainly welcome to turn them in on a 3x5 card or something. Just turn them in, and either in Bloomington over there or over here after the Bible study, and I'll get to them when I can get to them. One of the doctrines that we have not yet covered, there are 20 basic doctrines. I probably covered maybe 6 or 8 of them. I haven't actually counted them, but I probably covered a bunch of them. One that we have not yet covered is Satan the devil. And I've not had an opportunity to do him. One of the things that comes up in discussion from time to time, of course, is Satan the devil and his relationship to the church, and what's he doing? Is he doing things to the church? And Satan the devil is one of those topics that does come up. And in the course of the study, we'll take a look at some commonly asked questions about Satan the devil. Why is God allowing him to deceive human beings? Or will God destroy him in the end? There are all kinds of questions that people ask. Or why does God allow him to be released at the time of the millennium? You know, on a peaceful world, why would he do that? Or everybody probably has some kind of question about Satan the devil to ask. But I want to begin with the church's statement of belief concerning Satan the devil. I'm going to read through that to you, at least. We'll get that much done in this Bible study. It says, "We believe that Satan is a spirit being who is the adversary of God and the children of God. Satan has been given dominion over the world for a specific time. Satan has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Satan has ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious angels, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion." There are 5 key elements in that statement that are backed up by many scriptures. I won't try to read through and expound on them all, for this study would go for a long time if we did that. I probably won't have a chance to read through all of them. There are quite a few verses on him. So I'll try to read some in summary and just kind of a few on each topic having to do with him and answer some questions as we go along as well. Clearly we know that Satan has made himself the enemy or the adversary of God and of his people. And even the meanings of his name in both Hebrew and Greek demonstrate that. He opposes God and he opposes the work of God and the things that God is doing. At every opportunity that he has the opportunity to do so. And his hatred for God's plan is probably only exceeded by his hatred of every potential son of God and daughter of God that he can get his hands on and try to corrupt if he's able. And he's known and he is denounced in Scripture in a number of places, Revelation 12, verses 9 through 10, as a deceiver and the accuser of the brethren. He's also called a murderer and a liar and the father of lying in John 8:44. He's referred to by many derogatory terms. All of us have at one time or another found that we probably have opportunity in this life, unless you've been living in a cave at the top of a mountain somewhere. You've had contact with him at some point. Maybe you didn't really know you did or that he was involved in some way in a temptation in your life or in seeking to destroy you in some way. Certainly the angels of God are there to help protect us from those. We might call him the ultimate opponent, if you want to put it that way, I guess. If we take the opposite of God's plan to make spiritual sons who will rule the universe and judge angels under Jesus Christ, then you basically have Satan's plan. That's pretty much what he's out to do, is to prevent that. Stop God's plan, destroy potential sons of God, and not be ruled by anyone, but to be ruler himself. You know, that's pretty much where he's headed. And that summarizes his plan, if you're looking for a summarization of where he's going. You and I are right in his way. We are in his path. He doesn't like that. We are preventative to what he has in mind of what he'd like to do. Ephesians chapter 6 talks about it just a little bit. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 6, first of all. I'm running out of time. Ephesians chapter 6, let's read verses 11 through 18 real quickly here and then we'll quit. But it does give us a little bit of a summary here. It says, "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." We're being instructed by the Apostle Paul what to do to avoid him. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and against powers and against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." And that pretty well describes him and what he's doing. "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints." And Paul adds in the next verse, "for me" as well. And I can understand it. For those who are out actively preaching the gospel, there are a lot of dangers in this world. We have a lot of ministers in a lot of different difficult places, so keep them in your prayers. That's a good place to stop, and we'll pick it up next time. And we'll take a little break and come back.